How much would you spend to transform the lives of every denizen of one of America's great cities? What if we could dramatically improve the quality of life of every person in New York City or Miami or Atlanta or Los Angeles? Are we even daring enough to think that boldly? The answer, at least in Boston, is yes, we can dare that boldly, and my God, we are willing to spend so much to make it happen. That's the punchline of The Big Dig, a mega project that eliminated a traffic-clogged and ugly elevated highway that cut through the core of downtown and buried it through a series of tunnels. It's a project whose gestation and implementation took decades, and estimates of its final cost range from $10 to $20 billion. The mega project is derided as one of the great boondoggles of history, but my guest today, Ian Koss, sees something very different. Ian spent months interviewing, researching, and ultimately producing a 9-episode series for Boston's NPR affiliate GBH News on The Big Dig, and his conclusion is that when considered in its totality and with the benefit of history, The Big Dig was a steal, and the good type too. We talk about the merits of the Big Dig mega project, the complicated construction policies that made the project seem like a loser in front of the public, and just how hard it is to measure the true impact of a project that forever transformed one of America's founding cities. Let's dive in with Ian now about the history of the Big Dig. Maybe we could just get started with, how did you get into the Big Dig? Because it's not a popular subject. In general, it's maybe studied in a couple of, you know, history textbooks, Boston history, et cetera. But what drew you to the project, maybe arguably of the century?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a big story when I was growing up. So I'm of the age of people who grew up in Massachusetts during the Big Dig. You know, like it was just getting started around the time I was born. And it was still going on when I graduated high school, right? So it was just in the background the whole time. And I'm actually kind of amazed in a way that there hasn't been, you know, since then, you know, books and documentaries and more of a kind of retrospective of the project, because there was so much written and said about it at the time as it was going on. But then the legacy of it, you know, has never really been examined with distance and, you know, in that perspective. So my entry point to the story really comes from, I grew up kind of hearing about this terrible thing going on in Boston. It was over budget. It was behind schedule. It was a boondoggle fiasco. You know, pick your terrible word, it was called it. Fast forward, I moved to Boston as an adult. I live in the city now. I see with adult eyes, really for the first time, what the project was, you know, what the fruits of it were. And it was really a disconnect for me to see this thing that had transformed the city and was also this thing I had heard all these terrible, terrible stories about as a kid. So it's like, how are these the same project? And that was really the entry point for me of trying to connect the dots between what it had done and what I had heard about it when it was going on.
And maybe a great way to start out here would be, I mean, so let's talk about how terrible it was and what the Big Dig was trying to do. So massive freeways through the center of the city. I think there were, what, 4 or 5 lanes wide, double-decker in several parts of the city, right through the center. I mean, this doesn't really exist. I mean, in New York and Manhattan, we have, you know, the Hudson Parkway. We have FDR on the east side. They don't cut through. This was stopped in the kind of famous Jane Jacobs, Robert Moses fight to prevent the highway going through the center of the city. But that did not stop Boston. Boston puts highways right through the center of town. People live right next to them. How did the Big Dig kind of get going? How did it get started? What was the trigger for folks to start to reconsider this action?
Well, I would say that, you know, Boston did have an anti-highway movement like New York, like DC, like San Francisco. All around the country, you had this pushback to the freeways, you know, really that grew, kind of gained momentum in the 60s. And arguably, I mean, I do argue in the podcast that the Boston anti-highway movement was more radical and transformative than any of those other cities, because it really did manage by the early 1970s to totally transform the highway building policy of the whole state in a way that no other state did. And the Big Dig really grows out of that era, out of that activism. So, you know, you have all these roads that get canceled, but the road that did get built is this thing called the Central Artery. And that is the road we're talking about. It goes right through the historic downtown of Boston. It's three lanes in each direction. It's this hulking elevated barrier between, you know, City Hall and the Financial District and, you know, the Boston Common and the waterfront, you know, the historic harbor that built this city. You know, those things are cut off from each other by this interstate. And so coming out of the anti-highway movement, you know, this radical moment of reimagining cities and reimagining transportation, there is this idea that gets born. What if we could do better than just stopping highways, you know, and resisting highways? What if we could actually correct the mistakes of the past, tear down that highway that was built and replace it underground? And that really is the genesis of the Big Dig. That is the idea at the heart of it, to restore the heart of the city.
And when we think about it, I mean, so in San Francisco's case, there's a pullback on the Embarcadero Expressway on the east side of the city. Similarly, cut off the bay, this beautiful azure treasure, if you will, from the city. And in that particular case, it was actually knocked down by the forces of nature, right?
So
the
took a force of the act of God.
Act of God to get it down. But Boston actually does this through civil work. So what was sort of the story? So you have this kind of across America, kind of an anti-highway movement. So the interstate system comes in the 1950s. Environmentalism kind of gets triggered. Silent Spring, Rachel Carson. People are starting to connect the dots. And I think it's also appropriate for maybe a younger generation to always remind that like leaded fuel was still common at this time. I think we only moved to unleaded sometime in this era. So all those cars spewing leaded fumes and pollution. So you have all these triggers. And in Boston, you have this thing, the central artery cutting the entire city. But, you know, that usually doesn't stop this because the car culture and the, you know, kind of once you have it built, it's very, very hard to take anything down. And so it's exceptional when we do. What sort of got the momentum to actually make that go forward?
Yeah, I think I really appreciate you drawing attention to that because it's important to emphasize that nobody else is doing this, right? If you look around the major cities of America, yeah, the Embarcadero comes down by an act of God. Nobody else is tearing down highways and putting them underground. So why does this happen in Boston, right? And that was one of the questions that I had never considered as a child, for sure, and really started to think about as I looked at this story as a historical subject, like, why did this happen here at this time? How is it possible? And I would say, I would make two arguments here. The first is that the central artery was especially bad. You know, as far as downtown elevated highways go, it was not only ugly and disruptive, it was also truly dysfunctional. It was one of the first elevated highways built anywhere in the country. And so there are a lot of just kind of nuts and bolts aspects of this that the highway planners had not really figured out. It was windy. It had these tight turns. It had no breakdown lanes and shoulders. It had all these on-ramps and off-ramps that were just incredibly close together. And all of this combined to produce a road that was just gridlocked constantly for hours a day. And so there was, in addition to all the like lefty neighborhood activist types pushing to tear down this road, there were also business leaders who wanted to do something about this road and suburban commuters who wanted to do something about this road. So that's one thing. You have an unusually bad road here that needs to be dealt with somehow. The other thing you have is just a remarkable alignment of political leaders and political power that is able to drive this idea from conception to completion. Number one among those people who you'll hear about very quickly if you listen to the podcast is a remarkable Secretary of Transportation named Fred Savucci, who is just dogged and unstoppable in his drive to complete this project. But you also have to think about the kind of unique political power that the state of Massachusetts was wielding at this time. This is the 1980s. You've got Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, in the middle of the longest single tenure of any speaker in House in American history, right? You've got Michael Dukakis, the governor, who I know, you know, some people today might think of as the guy who lost the presidential election. But before he lost the presidential election, he was a nationally known, very popular, very powerful governor. You've got Senator John Kerry. You've got Senator Ted Kennedy. You've got a lot of very powerful people in key positions who could take on a big idea like this and get the local support, get the institutional support, you know, from the bureaucracies, and then crucially get the federal support to get it, the funding through Congress. It's just hard to imagine most cities mustering that kind of muscle. And in fact, you mentioned you're in New York. You know, New York City had its own version of the Big Dig, something called Westway. And the idea, maybe you're familiar with this project, was to put the West Side Highway underground. Very similar concept, you know, reconnect the city with its waterfront, improve transportation, public space, et cetera, et cetera. And that project just died in the same time period, in the 1980s. It died, you know, 1,000 deaths from environmental permitting and lack of political will. And so the Big Dig is the one that survived. It's this weird outlier that just had the right combination of people aligned behind it to make it happen.
And you know, is there officially a kickoff date? I'm always curious about this. I actually don't know, having lived next to a Big Dig, but like, was there a day that was like, this is the day it's going to start, and 2 years from now, a glorious tunnel is going to come out?
There's a great quote by William Weld, who was the governor of Massachusetts in the 90s. And he said, you know, this project has had more starts than Nolan Ryan. Nolan Ryan being, the famous pitcher, you know, starting pitcher of the same era. So it really is, it's one of these things that there were so many ribbon cuttings and, you know, press conferences and, you know, like there's so many moments when you could draw a line and say, this is it, it's starting. I can offer maybe a few, like a quick timeline of possible start dates. Take your pick. Ideas first proposed, 1972. It's first fully embraced by the governor, Michael Dukakis, in 1983. So that's in some ways the kickoff point of like, we are doing this. However, it then takes a while to get funding, to get the permitting. And so Dukakis has another kind of kickoff. We're doing it in 1989 when they actually, it's sort of like a groundbreaking. They break out the blowtorches and start cutting down some stuff that they're going to have to clear away to do the project. So that's 1989. And then I would argue that really construction begins in 1991. That's when they break out the TNT dynamite and like start blowing holes in the ground.
So 19 years from like kind of the first conception, first plan kind of on the table to kind of the launch. Yeah. You could literally say, you know, there's real construction underway.
Yeah, it's basically 20 years to get, you know, from idea to the starting line. And then it's another 16 years from shovels in the ground to the project is complete.
And the project complete date would be around 2007.
Yes.
What happens in between here? Because this is notorious as like one of the world's quote unquote most mismanaged projects. So let's get that on the table. We'll talk about its effects. But you had this kickoff in the 90s. We closed in 2007. And a lot of things take place. And one of which is sort of the cost inflation question. So how did the budget start? And how did it end up with the price tag that it got?
Yeah, the cost of the Big Dig is complicated. And it became such a big part of the story. Like it really came to kind of dominate the whole narrative around the project. And I think the most important thing to understand about the cost of the Big Dig is that the numbers, if you just look at the kind of, this is what we thought, this is what it ended up being, they look really, really bad. Like they look just unforgivably bad. And yet, there are many reasons why those costs went up. And most of those reasons are just like, they're not because somebody was corrupt and somebody was, you know, stealing the bacon. Most of the reasons they went up is like kind of mundane bureaucratic things that are endemic to the way we build infrastructure in this country. And so part of the reason I love this story of the Big Dig is it's a great case study for understanding why infrastructure in general is expensive. Because the things that made it expensive are the things that make all big projects expensive. So if we look at the numbers, the earliest estimates, if we go back to 1983, right? This is the first Mike Dukakis gets up on stage, points at the map on the wall and says, we're going to build it. About $2.2 billion is the number that he floats that day. When construction is all said and done, it's almost $15 billion, 14.8, right? So that's a lot of billions of dollars of increase, right? And I think to understand that increase, you kind of got to break it down into chunks. First off, inflation. Back in the 1980s, and this is actually kind of weird, when they estimated the cost of projects, they did not account for inflation. So this is a project that ended up taking, you know, more than, you know, from that 1983 to 2007, do the math, 25 years pretty much, no inflation was accounted for. And that policy actually changed while the big dig was underway. Like mid-dig, Federal Highway, the folks in DC who write the rules were like, oh, by the way, all budgets now have to account for future inflation through the end of the project. This is one of many ways in which the big dig just got kind of screwed. Just terrible timing. We're like partway through, like, these are the numbers. These are the numbers. Oh, actually, sorry, we have to inflate the numbers. So that's a big one. Then the other big bucket you have to look at is what the technical word for it would be scope change. The project itself changed. And I think this, again, this is true of Second Avenue Subway. It's true of any big project, infrastructure project in America, is that once these things get rolling, other things kind of get stuck onto them, right? Other projects people want to see, mitigation projects, you know, that help kind of, you know, improve the environmental impact or the community impact. And so the big dig becomes this kind of rolling juggernaut of a snowball for decades, you know, because it's got this federal money, it's got all this political will behind it. And so, you know, if all you're doing is looking at those numbers and saying, well, it's supposed to be $2 billion and it ended up being $15 billion, like, what a ripoff. But the thing is that $2 billion price tag was a totally different project. And so that's a lot of what the story is that, you know, we tell in the podcast is how these other things kind of became part of the project, how it expanded and grew. And then I think the third category that, you know, you gotta just acknowledge as part of it is that it was harder than people thought. It was always going to be a weird kind of bespoke project. No one had really done anything quite like this before. There were not good models that you could look at for estimates. There was a lot of political incentive, you know, to kind of downplay, minimize the costs, to say, oh, it's not going to be so bad, you know, let's just get it through Congress. And so the reality is that it was underestimated on many levels, technically, and, you know, labor involved and everything. And so the result of all these things, right, the ever snowballing scope, the compounding inflation, the fact that it had been underestimated from the beginning, those three things all kind of come together in the 1990s and produce this series of cost jumps. And this is when the cost really becomes the narrative of the big dig, because it's like you've got reporters at the Herald and you've got reporters at the Globe. This isn't a time when you actually had competing newspapers, local news coverage, beat reporters out, you know, going to the press conferences, talking to engineers, digging through the files. And it just sort of becomes this slow drip of, is it 5.5? Is it 6.6? Is it 7.7? Is it 10.8? Really building to a crescendo in the year 2000, when the project takes its single biggest cost increase. It's a huge scandal, resignations, investigations, you know, people dragged down into Congress to testify in Washington. John McCain is out on the campaign trail at that time. He starts using it as a talking point. And so I think that 2000 moment is really when the image of the big dig crystallizes in the public imagination as the boondoggle in Boston.
It is a good exemplar of how hard a lot of this stuff is. So first of all, emphasizing on the part of inflation, you know, one of the challenges of the U.S. is most of our infrastructure does take a long time to build, particularly if you look at equivalent projects. And the big dig's fairly sui generis, but if you were to look at like a subway expansion, very common in East Asia, parts of Europe, usually does not take 15 to 20 years to go build one of these projects. And so even in a relatively low inflationary environment, when you are compounding 2% or 3% a year over 20 years, those final dollars are significantly more expensive than the original dollars. And then you go in reverse and you go back to the 80s when inflation was high in the early years of the Reagan administration. This is the Paul Volcker, when Volcker and then eventually Alan Greenspan take over the Fed and they try to do, you know, cold medicine and try to get everyone back to better inflation out of the stagflation years. You know, these numbers are going up 10, 12% a year. So those extra years really, really start to metastasize and increase really, really fast. So that is a huge challenge. I was actually shocked to hear that they didn't include inflation. That's ironic, particularly given the time. But, you know, you learn something over time. We're getting better at budgeting all the time. Number two, you talked about scope. You called it scope change. I like to call it scope creep because scoping is bad. But, you know, I always give this example, and I probably have lost the link, but there was a new swimming pool being built in San Francisco down the street from me where I used to live. Public pool was designed as like kind of a community center and was something like $60 million or some, you know, astronomical sum. And people were like, well, how could a swimming pool possibly be cost this much money? And so I downloaded the site plan and like all the stuff that was going on. And it wasn't a swimming pool. It was like a swimming pool, several a public park, public bathrooms, changes to like four streets worth of street landscaping, the roads themselves, bike lanes, new parking. There's like a parking deck attached to it, upgraded sewage. And so similar to what you're talking about, I usually call them barnacles. But once one of these projects in the American system tends to get momentum, people are like, oh, that's the engine that's going. Like, we're going to jump on that one over there. And suddenly you realize like the swimming pool is only like $2 or $3 million of the 60 that was spent. Everything else was some other choice, whether it's a mitigation, as you mentioned, for environment or a community benefit is usually under the category for this. And so oftentimes it's actually really hard to compare like with like. So that's one of the reasons I personally love some of the research that looks at like road construction costs. So if you're just building like a two-lane county road in different states, you get a sense of, you know, the material is roughly the same. The rules are generally at the federal level, you need certain standards. And so the quality can't be so divergent and it's relatively fungible and comparable as a way of analysis.
I think this is why I always struggle to describe what the big dig is, you know, because on one level it was about tearing down an elevated highway and putting underground, like I described. But it really, what it becomes is a kind of wholesale renovation, like kitchen renovation of downtown Boston, because it's not just that one highway. It's there are multiple tunnels, multiple bridges, involves rerouting like all these utilities, you know, thousands of miles of utilities into downtown Boston, giving this very old city a very, you know, a totally updated utility grid. You know, it's about parkland. It's about there's some mass transit improvements. You know, it's, you know, some of the dirt that was excavated for the tunnel ends up being used to cap this island and the harbor that was basically a trash dump for many decades, you know, and restoring it to part. So it's so hard to like describe everything it was because of that barnacle effect you described. And that's where, again, the sort of there's just this disconnect where like we think of it as like we thought we were just paying for a tunnel. Why is it $15 billion? But we were also getting so much more.
And then this gets at a little bit, I think, of your part three there when you're talking about some of these costs, which is, I'm going to mispronounce his last name because it's Dutch, but Ben Freiberg, who has done a lot of work around mega projects, or Freiberg, I'll try to throw in a little. There you go.
I spoke with him when I was working on the project.
Fantastic. Yes.
And he was in Boston in the 80s as a, I don't know if he was a grad student or doing some research here, but he met Fred Salvucci. He heard about this project early on, so he was very familiar with it, actually.
And he just published his book on mega projects. So he spent 2-3 decades collecting data on mega projects, probably best well known for his work around the cost of Olympics and how they almost never, at least in his mathematics and calculus, never succeed for the cities, I think, except for LA. You know, in his book, he really emphasizes the importance of standardization. So this idea of like, look, if you do the same thing over and over and over again, you really start to save costs. People get trained up. People start to know what they need to do. So for instance, I used to live in Seoul, South Korea, cheapest subway construction costs in the world. And part of the reason is that the crews who are working these lines and building these new stations and tunnels have done it so many times over and over again. They're quite standardized. There's some aesthetic differences from like a public arts perspective, so a little bit of different tiling or whatever, but fundamentally they're all identical. So the fire escape system and everything else that goes into this has already been pre-planned. It's already optimized. It already follows the rules. And so you don't have as much of this sort of undiscovered, unknown, where you're like, oh, we had no idea because we're tunneling here. We're going to have to think about a certain type of rock that happens to be on this side of the city versus that side of the city. They already have that knowledge pre-built. And so I think, like, you know, this is where the challenge, though, is how do you start to communicate these benefits to the public? So on one hand, it was kind of misscoped narratively. You're talking about, we're going to put this thing on underground. Okay, we're going to get a tunnel. It's hard to sell, like, we're going to have new utility wires. It's also hard to describe over time, and this is where we started the show, of like 20 years now from the, or almost 20 years since the final kind of close of the project, how much the city has changed. I live near where that elevated highway would have been. I live near South Station in Boston, would have been right there. You know, that is now replaced with parks. The traffic is much less than it used to be. You know, the cityscape is open. There's a ton of new buildings that are getting built. And so the question I actually have always had is like, is all that new residential and construction growth right on that park next to it, all that additional value, all of the growth and the wealth that it basically comes into downtown Boston, you know, was that enough to compensate for this project cost? So it actually was like a winner. Just took a little time to count it as a winner, but was it a winner?
I mean, I have neither the skills or time to like try and tabulate that. But what I'll tell you is this, I interviewed a lot, you know, we interviewed almost 100 people for this podcast. I talked to a lot of very smart people who said that just in raw economic terms, this project, you know, was a bargain. That for, you know, in terms of the economic development that it kicked off, it was absolutely worth it. Because like you said, I mean, there's so, I mean, the value of that real estate, you know, and the amount of businesses that have flowed in. If you look at, there's this neighborhood sort of right next to downtown called the Seaport. Now we call it the Seaport. I don't know, you know, it's essentially a brand new neighborhood. If you rewind 20 years, it was basically docks and parking lots and a few warehouses. That area is now, you know, filled with biotech and hotels and art museums and concert venues. And so, and that's all because of the big dig. That the Seaport went from corner of the city that was kind of out of the way and really hard to access to becoming the most accessible part of downtown Boston because it's connected to the airport, it's connected to all the interstates, it's connected by mass transit. So the big dig really created the Seaport. So, I mean, if you just like added up the, you know, real estate taxes on every building in the Seaport, I mean, GE moved its world headquarters to right where the big dig was. Like that's the kind of economic development that this project stimulated. I should say, I mean, I don't want to say that this is like a total unmitigated good. I mean, there's obviously gentrification that comes along with this, changing neighborhoods aesthetically, design-wise. I think you could, you know, raise all kinds of critiques and questions about how the Seaport was built up, how the land around the, you know, the old highway was redeveloped. I think those are, there are a lot of valid questions and critiques. But yes, if you're looking at dollars and cents, this project has brought in, you know, an incredible amount of money for the city.
You know, I used to live in the Seaport. It has developed a lot. When I lived there, there was, you know, only, it was still mostly parking lots. It was starting to finally like go through. And I recently walked through it last year and I was just shocked to see, you know, dozens of buildings, a little too much glass for me. It's a little too much, you know, talking about aesthetic concerns. I was like, hey, how about, this is a historical city. Everything doesn't have to be glass to kind of fight back. I think one of the big questions that comes up with these sorts of mega projects though, which you're getting at is this concern around discount rates. So this was a popular theme in like Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry of the Future. It's popular in a lot of climate change mitigation projects. But the idea of like, look, the benefits come, they're worth a lot. You know, when we built the New York City subway 100 years ago, like those train tunnels and those stations are still here. Now, they're barely here in some cases, but they are here and people use them every day. And that investment continues to accrue because even though we have to maintain them, we don't have to build them. And so there's this like fundamental infrastructure wealth and kind of physical and built environment wealth that comes to the city because we were willing to make those investments. And so the question always becomes, you know, these mega projects, yes, it was very expensive, it's upfront, but then these benefits accrue for generations. And the challenge is that in a lot of these models, you know, you're sort of budgeting for 15-year and like 15-year benefits or 20-year benefits, even though this tunnel theoretically has a lifetime of a century or more, or forever if you maintain it well. You know, it's a, as of now, seismically secure location for Boston. But
climate change raises some questions about the viability of downtown tunnels.
And so it's always one of these tough challenges because the cost, you bear so much of the cost up front. And particularly in a world where, you know, it's globalized, Boston has a lot of turnover, a lot of students, you know, obviously come. Sometimes they pay taxes or whatever because they move their residency. Sometimes they don't. So you're paying taxes for this project that you're not going to get any benefit for over the next 200 years, not alive. You're not going to come. So there's a little bit of challenge on some of this sort of stuff. But I always think of it as, how do you kind of account for that? Because clearly, if you want to do these mega projects, you have to have a long-term, like a very deeply long-term vision for this. Maybe that's partly your work in trying to popularize, sort of look at these benefits over 20 years and compare the old photos. But I'm just curious of, like, do you think that there's a world in which we can bring a longer-term lens to some of these projects and imprint that either at the local, state, or federal levels in the United States?
To me, that is a central paradox of infrastructure, you know, that like media works on a 24-hour cycle, you know, and then, you know, politics obviously is working on a 2 or 4 year kind of election cycle. And then we've got the big dig on a 40-year cycle, right? These scale, these things are, I mean, it's really hard to reconcile those things. And I don't know what the answer is to that. You know, it's easy for me to sit here now and say, oh, like you have to tell the story and you have to like explain. But, you know, they knew this stuff. You know, they had smart people doing PR for the big dig at the time. And, you know, they knew all the, you know, a lot of the things that we know now. And still, you know, they were not able to muster that support and convey what the benefits of this project were going to be. So I don't think there are easy fixes, but I do see a value. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this project was to revisit the story, to tell it again with that distance and perspective, because now we can see the long arc, right? We can see it from conception to completion and, you know, the legacy and impacts.
So you did this 9-episode podcast series, really, really well produced. You interviewed 100 folks, obviously a very serious subject. But I'm curious, across all of those different interviews, was there a funny anecdote, a funny observation?
One of the storylines that I like, if I could have done a 10th episode, I really wanted to do one that was just about the media, that was just about the reporters and like the work they were doing and the narratives they were shaping. And there's this one story that a reporter told me that it's funny. I end up telling this story to other people so much that it makes me feel like, shoot, I really should have included that, because clearly it's something that stuck with me in a very deep way. When the tunnel opened in 2003, this is the downtown, what we call the Tip O'Neill Tunnel. This was like the moment of triumph for this project, right? What should have been the moment of triumph. It ended up getting a little muddied. And so the story is that I interviewed this Globe reporter who was the, sort of the beat transportation reporter at the time. And he told me the story about how he went to his editor, and it's like a month before opening. It's like, okay, it's finally here, the big dig. We're finally going to see it. And the word from the editor was, go out and find me something that's wrong with this thing. And don't come back until you do. And I just
sounds like the
that.
Boston Globe, actually.
I mean, you know, there's that line in the podcast about this is a city of sports, politics, and revenge, right? I mean, it is, politics is blood sport here. And the news media is cutthroat. And yes, it is in some, there are some things about this story that are just very Boston. I think the media environment here is very harsh. And you see it in the sports, you see it in the politics. It is a harsh, harsh light to be under. And so this reporter told me the story about how the dutiful beat reporter he was, he went out and he reported about how, well, they were supposed to have an orchestra playing in the tunnel when it opened, and it was going to cost all this money. And if, you know, there was some sponsor that was paying for like 90% of it, but there was still the other 10%. So that's a big story. And then there's the story that, and you can find all these in the Globe, the month leading up to the opening, there was this concern about how the grade of the highway going down into the tunnel had this one kind of steep spot. And there was this concern that like the cars would come down it, and because it was like coming off this bridge and going into a tunnel, that there would be all this moisture if it was wet, and then it might freeze. And then like there would be this like wildly dangerous skating rink ski slope going down the tunnel. And so he wrote this whole article about, you know, the grade of the tunnel, and they had a diagram. And the, you know, if you look at the diagram, it's like vertical scale has been magnified 10 times to help you see. So it really looks like a roller coaster ride because they've like amplified, you know, the y-axis to help you see it. And then, of course, we get to opening day, December 2003. You know, and it's fine. You know, they flip a switch, the last car goes up, the first car goes down, and everything's fine. And this reporter, you know, that he, you know, was reflecting on it now and being like, yeah, there might have been some moments where the cynicism kind of got away from us.
You know, that may be a good tagline for this securities podcast series in general. There's just sometimes when your cynicism gets away from you. But Ian, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate the work. And definitely we'll have links to all of the different episodes for all nine on The Big Dig. And I'm looking forward to your next project.
I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to figuring out what that next project is and how it can possibly bring it to life. But I'm working on it.
Absolutely. Ian, thank you so much.
The Securities Podcast is produced by Chris Gates, and we'll have many more episodes on science, technology, finance, and the human condition coming out soon.